August 3rd, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are in danger, everyone! Danger, Will Robinson! Danger! This chapter is called Danger. This is important.
This is very important, Steve. And south of Pennsylvania is a state called Maryland. And in Maryland, there's a city called Baltimore. And we need to know a little bit about Baltimore because there's an Illinois connection to it.
Other than the Hairspray song, which is all I can think of when I think of Baltimore. Go on.
Or the Coats. The
Good
Coats,
morning,
Steve.
Baltimore.
The Coats moved to Indianapolis, right? All right, so what we need to know is a little bit about a guy named Alan Pinkerton. And we need to know a little bit about that he had a national detective agency. And that he was in charge of security for President Abraham Lincoln in 1861. And there was a conspiracy to try to kill him. Although it's been contested over the years, let's just say that may have something to do with our story. And we may want to at least think about it a little bit.
I love that you brought that up, Chip, because I actually really have enjoyed Alan Pinkerton's work over the years. He wrote 17 sort of memoirs, which are highly embellished tales of his work as a detective. And one of them does involve this Abraham Lincoln story. And you know what? Historians are not convinced that the Baltimore plot even really existed. But in the novelization, I want to say novel, then I kind of make itization. Pinkerton basically says that he put a big shawl over Abraham Lincoln's head and made him look like a little old woman and led him along so no one knew it was Abraham Lincoln, which is how he saved his life.
6'4", spindly, right? Little old woman. Okay, go on.
all I'm going to say is, what Pinkerton didn't have was a Watson to document things. And if he did, probably would be taken a little more seriously.
I agree with that.
Now, that is totally true. And so Pinkerton, he has a super fascinating story. And he was a barrel maker before he became a detective. There was a local crime that he ended up solving. And I can't remember all the details. It was sort of a Huck Finn style crime with an island and some sort of bootlegging or whatever. But Pinkerton actually opened the very first private detective agency in the U.S. in 1855. And so he was working alongside the police. In America, he was sort of the Sherlock Holmes figure, right? Except he was a private detective, and he very quickly, not a consulting detective, you know what I mean? And then he very quickly created this whole agency. And do you guys know the logo of the Pinkerton Agency? Can you picture what it looks like?
No.
It still exists today. It's called Securitas now. But it's a big open eye, and the words "We never sleep" are in like a little half circle above the eye. So it's this notion of detectives as surveillance, right? This notion that I think we get very much in this American part of the Sherlock Holmes story, that the police that we've met already, they're not your friend. They're not protecting you. They're not solving crimes on your behalf. They're watching you. Not always fun to be watched.
Looks a little bit like the CBS logo in many ways.
Oh, the giant eye. The giant eye looking at you through the television. Yeah, not creepy at all, CBS. Thanks for that. And then they aired The Twilight Zone. So there was a giant eye in the opening of The Twilight Zone on CBS. It's like, there's too many eyeballs.
Yeah. And that notion, again, like in the late 19th century, who are the police? Like, what is their relationship to the average citizen? It's a real question that I think Doyle is exploring in this novel with its big British section and its big American section.
So. Thankfully, that question has been resolved, right?
As Jerry Seinfeld would say, who are these people?
Uh-huh. Yeah. So this chapter opens, as many chapters do, but boy, is this quite another paragraph that Doyle gives us in the opening.
It was the height of the Reign of Terror. McMurdo, who had already been appointed inner deacon with every prospect of someday succeeding McGinty as bodymaster, was now so necessary to the counsels of his comrades that nothing was done without his help and advice. The more popular he became, however, with the freemen, the blacker were the scowls which greeted him as he passed along the streets of Vermissa. In spite of their terror, the citizens were taking heart to band themselves together against their oppressors. Rumors had reached the lodge of secret gatherings in the Herald office and of distribution of firearms among the law-abiding people. But McGinty and his men were undisturbed by such reports. They were numerous, resolute, and well-armed. Their opponents were scattered and powerless. It would all end, as it had done in the past, in aimless talk and possibly in impotent arrests. So said McGinty, McMurdo, and all the bolder spirits. In this opening, we get another sort of time passes sort of feeling that we had in that in the last chapter as well. So now McMurdo has been promoted to be inner deacon, whatever that is. Sounds like they're using terminology from the church, right? Mm-hmm. And it's typically someone in a church hierarchy. And you'll note that there's this real anxiety among the townspeople. We've seen that building, but now it's to the point where the townspeople are actually arming themselves. So to be like an informal militia against your informal militia is what it kind of sounds like. So mm-hmm. seems like things are getting super, super tense.
Can you speculate as to how much time has passed here? Are we talking about a month? Are we talking about more than that?
3 to 6 months, I would say.
Okay.
And again, I would say something like that. Because, you know, once again, he's got to have time to perform something to move up.
Mm-hmm. Brother Morris comes to McMurdo with a telegram that that has been intercepted.
That's not Thaddeus, his brother, is it, Steve?
What? I'm sorry. Brother Bartholomew? No, this is Brother Morris.
We can only wish, my friends. We can only wish for Brother Bartholomew. And you... Hey, at least we had Marvin in this story. Bringing it back. So, remember how Doyle got this idea for the Valley of Fear from Alan Pinkerton's son, William? Well, here's where this telegram starts to bring that into relief. "I can tell it to you all in one sentence," said Brother Morris. "There's a detective on our trail. It's no man of the district. As you say, we know them, and it is little that they can do. But you've heard of Pinkertons?" "I've heard of some folk of that name," says McMurdo. "Well, you can take it from me, you've no show when they are on your trail. It's not a take it or miss it government concern. It's a dead earnest business proposition that's out for results and keeps out till by hook or crook it gets them. If a Pinkerton man is deep in this business, we are all destroyed." And so suddenly there's this outside threat. And we get in the opening that the Scourers really are not very worried about the local folks arming up. Like they feel perfectly safe. But it seems like Brother Morris, at least, the weaker of all of the brothers of the lodge, is pretty concerned that if the Pinkertons come to town, that is
all is lost.
A legitimate threat.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what would really make it great is if Doyle like gave him like a real name that kind of really said, "I'm a detective."
Tom Cotton.
Yeah.
No, that's a real guy.
You mean a no. real name like Sherlock Holmes?
Sure.
Mycroft. No, this detective's name is Birdie Edwards.
That's right. Detective Birdie Edwards.
It's enough to strike fear in the heart of any man.
Watch out for Birdie. He's watching you.
But you guys, it's really interesting how in the UK, in the British version, you know, Sherlock Holmes very much works alone with his sidekick, Watson, right? And he consults with the detectives, with the official detectives, but he says, "Oh, you know, you just let me do my work and then I will tell you, I will solve the case and you guys can take the credit." But he works super separately. In the American context, we've just been introduced to how organized crime works. And now we're going to get introduced to how the Pinkerton organization, a huge national agency, takes on the same sorts of attributes as organized crime. This is organized detection. And it's private. So it's a for-profit enterprise instead of being the local governmentally funded police. So this is where you get some really interesting notions of like who controls law and order and in what way is crime an industry? And then in what way is detection an industry? Because the Pinkertons are very much seen by many as being on the side of capital against the labor class, against unions. So super, the history of the Pinkertons, I'm sorry, you get me excited. It's very fascinating.
Really? You should have mentioned this about, 126 days ago when we started this conversation. Yes, Pam, we know that you are all about your study of the Pinkertons and these detective novels. Excellent work. McMurdo is genuinely frightened at the news that Brother Morris brings to him, but he does not show it to Morris. It was clear from his actions that he thought more seriously of this new intrusion than his words would show. It may have been his guilty conscience. It may have been the reputation of the Pinkerton organization. It may have been the knowledge that great rich corporations had set themselves the task of clearing out the Scourers. But whatever his reason, his actions were those of a man who was preparing for the worst. Every paper which would incriminate him was destroyed before he left the house. After that, he gave a long sigh of satisfaction, for it seemed to him that he was safe, and yet the danger must still have pressed somewhat upon him, for on his way to the lodge, he stopped at old man Shafter's. The house was forbidden him, but when he tapped at the window, Eddie came out. The dancing Irish deviltry had gone from her lover's eyes. She read his danger in his earnest face. Wow, what a paragraph that is, Doyle.
Lot going on here, folks. So McMurdo tries to clear out his home from all the evidence, because remember, he's now in the inner deacon circle, so he's presumably got lots of documentation. And now, isn't this interesting? So even though the Shafter house is forbidden to him, like, Eddie is paying no attention to her father. So she's quite a little rebel American girl, right? She's this 19-year-old feisty German-American girl who is completely undissuaded by her father's not only forbidding her to see McMurdo, but even forbidding him to enter their house. Remember, he used to take his meals. He used to live there. Then he still took meals there. Now he's not allowed there at all, but she doesn't care. This is her devilish Irish lover.
Well, she's hopelessly devoted.
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking right now go ahead and cue our love theme. It's going to be a slow rock theme that's going to talk about the power of love.
You don't think Hopelessly Devoted was the right song?
Well, it could be. Could be.
Wrong show. McMurdo feels that the danger is approaching, and he tells Eddie all about it.
Well, and it's interesting how she reacts here, too. So, you shall come with me. If this valley is closed to me and I can never come back, how can I leave you behind? And me, perhaps, in hiding from the police with never a chance of a message. It's with me you must come. I know a good woman in the place I come from, and it's there I'd leave you till we can get married. Will you come? Yes, Jack, I will come.
Wait, was that his marriage proposal?
I mean,
that was it, right?
Kind of looks like it.
That's as less romantic as it could possibly be.
Hey, listen, when you're talking about McMurdo or you're talking about Indiana Jones, it's about getting things done, Steve. You don't even have
that
to.
Was it. That was the marriage proposal. I know a woman. I'll leave you there till we can get married. Wait. You buried the lead.
I'm pretty sure that there's no way Eddie would continue to see this guy if he wasn't promising her marriage all along.
Okay.
And she makes an incredible strudel, Steve.
Oh, dear. And so McMurdo continues, God bless you for your trust in me. It's a fiend out of hell that I should be if I abused it. Now, mark you, Eddie, it will be just a word to you. And when it reaches you, you will drop everything and come right down to the waiting room at the depot. And stay there till I come for you. And then she continues on. Yes, Jack, I will be there. But basically, so he's saying here, this is an interesting moment in terms of 19th century mores, that he's like, initially, remember, he had said, hey, we'll take your father with us. We'll just leave this place. Give me 6 months. And now, no mention of Jacob Shafter at all. He's like, I'm going to get word to you. You're going to drop everything. We've got a meeting place. We're going to flee, and I'll marry you. Don't worry.
I'm reaching here, but maybe a statement of a melting pot. It's a country where no one really has any ties to any particular place. You're kind of finding a new way of creating relationships. And we have a lot of Germans marrying the Irish, or, you know, Irish marrying the Italians, or, you know, any other group that that's going on there. So maybe a little bit a democratization of finding your true love.
Welcome to America. You're all from somewhere, but we're all in this together. Also the wrong show. McMurdo brings the telegram to the lodge and brings to the attention of all the lodge members that this is a dangerous situation that is coming their way.
And it's interesting that one of the older brothers seems to actually know of Bertie Edwards. So Bertie Edwards has a bit of a reputation here. Let me say, Mr. Chairman, said one of the older brethren, that I've heard of Bertie Edwards and that he has the name of being the best man in the Pinkerton service. Does anyone know him by sight? Asked McGinty. Yes, said McMurdo. I do. Now, comes as a surprise to the reader, right? He certainly didn't tell Brother Morris that.
Mm-hmm. Because he was asking Brother Morris questions about this guy, and he did not know him. And now the story is that he does know him by sight. He's met with him, actually. We'll get to that in a minute.
And I'm sorry, we didn't really write this in there, but there's a parliamentary procedure that was brought in front of McGinty to force this to be the first subject. Like, I'm going to say this, and this is more important than anything else we're going to discuss.
Everybody organized. Knows that outlaws use Robert's rules. Obvious.
Really important. Really important. You got to keep notes. Those notes will come
organized
in
crime.
Exactly.
This is evidence of the organization of the organized crime.
Well, and the idea that it's a business.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That this is a true business.
There's like a bureaucratization of both crime and detection in the 70s in America. Absolutely.
So, of course, the first thing that you do when you're in danger, they form a committee.
Steve, let me tell you about trade embargoes and the Star Wars universe.
This is how democracy dies in the Senate.
Always a Star Wars reference for you, Steve.
So McMurdo goes before the Brotherhood and he says, Eminent Bodymaster, said McMurdo earnestly, I would put it to you that this is too vital a thing for us to discuss in open lodge. God forbid that I should throw a doubt on anyone here, but if so much as a word of gossip got to the ears of this man, there would be an end of any chance of our getting him. I would ask the lodge to choose a trusty committee, Mr. Chairman, yourself, if I may suggest it, and Brother Baldwin here, and five more. Then I can talk freely of what I know and of what I advise should be done. The proposition was at once adopted and the committee chosen. Besides the chairman and Baldwin, there were the vulture-faced secretary, Haraway, Tiger Cormac, the brutal young assassin, Carter, the treasurer, and the brothers Willoughby, fearless and desperate men who would stick at nothing. So we get basically this, we get this specific committee and they go into an in-camera session. So there will not be notes when you go into this kind of session. There will be no minutes of their work, the way there are minutes of all of, that are attached to each of the other agendas.
Organized crime. Heavy emphasis on the organized here. They are very careful with their business here.
Yeah.
Did they order sandwiches?
It was not, I'm sorry, that was not in the notes. I don't know if they ordered sandwiches.
Sandwiches and coffee. I'm sorry, whiskey. I'm sorry, they always have whiskey.
And it was probably at an irregular hour, I would guess.
McMurdo reports that he has actually spoken to this Bertie Edwards character. He said, I said just now that I knew Bertie Edwards. I need not tell you that he is not here under that name. He's a brave man, but not a crazy one. He passes under the name of Steve Wilson, and he is lodging at Hobson's Patch. There you go. That's a detective name, Chip. Steve Wilson is on their trail. His real name is Birdie, but his fake name is Steve. Of course it is. How do I know this? Because I fell into talk with him. I thought little of it at the time, nor would have given it a second thought, but for this letter. But now I'm sure it's the man. I met him on the cars when I went down the line on Wednesday. A hard case if ever there was one. He said he was a reporter. I believed it for the moment. Wanted to know all he could about the Scourers and what he called the outrages for a New York paper. Asked me every kind of question so as to get something. You bet I was giving nothing away. I'd pay for it and pay well, said he, if I could get some stuff that would suit my editor. I said what I thought would please him best, and he handed me a $20 bill for my information. There's 10 times that for you, said he, if you can find me all that I want. This is quite a development.
And it's interesting because we also see how much time has passed, because after this, Bodymaster McGinty is like, what did you tell him? And he's like, meh, I just made stuff up. No worries. And he basically just trusts McMurdo's judgment on what to tell this fake reporter.
Which is probably in his interest right there. I'm sure that it will serve him well.
McGinty. McMurdo is definitely trusted. There's no doubt that McGinty 100% trusts McMurdo at this point. So, yes, the time has passed.
He's a deacon, of course.
So McMurdo goes on further to nominate himself to go to Hobson's Patch and to find this man.
And he says he's going to find him through the telegraph operator, because what he learned when he was there before is that this guy, Steve Wilson, would send a telegram in cipher every single day. And he said it was his newspaper stories. But now it all seems so clear, right? He's probably actually sending a detective report every day. So McMurdo says, I'll go to the patch tomorrow morning. I'll find him through the operator. He can locate him, I guess. Well, then I'll tell him that I'm a freeman myself. I'll offer him all the secrets of the lodge for a price. You bet he'll tumble to it. I'll tell him the papers are at my house and that it's as much as my life would be worth to let him come while folk were about. He'll see that that's horse sense. Let him come at 10 o'clock at night and he shall see everything. That will fetch him sure. So this is a scene where he's telling these guys in the committee, we are going to set up this detective.
Seems like a pretty good setup.
It does.
Right? If this is what's happening, this guy would come running to get the information that he needs, for sure.
Well, I hope Eddie's ready in time. What?
Oh, boy. There might be a different setup happening, huh, Chip? It might be something else other than what the author's telling us, Chip.
Well, as a magician, yeah, it's all about taking your eyes somewhere else, Steve. It's the prestige.
Aha! You mean the chapter before the last chapter? We're setting up something that's going to happen? Yeah, I agree with you, Chip.
This brings us to the ending of the chapter, when McMurdo says, you can plan the rest for yourselves. Widow McNamara's is a lonely house. She's as true as steel and as deaf as a post. There's only Scanlan and me in the house. If I get his promise, and I'll let you know if I do, I'd have the whole seven of you come to me by 9 o'clock. We'll get him in. If ever he gets out alive, well, he can talk of Bertie Edwards' luck for the rest of his days. There's going to be a vacancy at Pinkerton's, or I'm mistaken. Leave it at that, McMurdo. At 9 tomorrow, we'll be with you. You once get the door shut behind him, and you can leave the rest with us. So this feels like exactly the kind of setup that we often see at the end of a Sherlock Holmes story, where you get everybody in a room and you reveal who the murderer is.
You get the murderer to come to your rooms.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a Sherlock way of doing things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That is very much how this works in Sherlock's
universe.
And
so here you're going to get the detective to come to your house. And then you're going to let him know who the criminals really are.
Mm-hmm. I look forward to that. This is going to be quite a last chapter. We have one more chapter of this story. The full climax is there. All the setup is here in chapter 6 for the climax, all of the action to happen in chapter 7.
And the final chapter of the American part, The Scourers, chapter 7 is called The Trapping of Bertie Edwards. Then it's followed in the novel by a very, very brief epilogue, just a page and a half or whatever. So should we do both of those tomorrow?
Yes, we are going to cover both the climax of this story and the epilogue that follows it tomorrow.
It's unfair because you know that those poor readers in 1915 had to wait a whole extra month for that, like, two-page epilogue. But we're not going to.
Really? But we're modern people, and we don't wait. Let's go Netflix, baby.
Netflix. We're Netflixing exactly. This, not Hulu. We're not going to watch Hulu on this one. We're going to go Netflix and just skip to the denouement at the end because it's kind of important. Yeah. I hope everybody out there is ready for the climax of this story tomorrow and the epilogue. We'll do both. I hope you're excited for all this happenings that are occurring in this far off place and looking forward to it as much as we are. We would love to hear from you. We would love to hear your ideas for our wrap-up show talking about two topics. First, what's your favorite of these 60 stories from Arthur Conan Doyle? And second, what are your favorite Sherlock Holmes tropes? What are those things that we've seen over and over again in these stories that are your favorites? We need two lists from you. You've got homework for our upcoming wrap-up show. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all that feedback from around the world, and go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches at regularhours.com. to get all of these conversations. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasenflug.
And I'm Pam Fedora, welcoming you to the Valley of Fear. What I want to talk about, what I want to thank you for, what I want to thank you for, it means so very much without you. I would never see the light.
Bertie Edwards. Or should I call you Steve Wilson?